Wherefore, I, Lehi, prophesy according to the workings of the Spirit which is in me, that there shall none come into this land, save as shall be brought by the hand of the Lord. I'm talking today with Martha Vasquez, who left Honduras when she was 17 years old in 1991, pregnant with her second child, and made her way on foot through Central and then South America to enter the United States. She was eventually granted asylum, and she joined the army at the age of 34 with four children. That was her dream. That's what brought her here. And today she continues to work with the population of asylum seekers here in the Phoenix, Arizona area. Okay, so I'm speaking with Martha Vasquez, and she has such an interesting story that I was so interested in hearing. I've heard so many people talk about you, and I just wanted to get to the bottom of really why so many people are so compelled by your story.
I was born in Honduras, and I grew up there, and I got pregnant at the age of 13. And then as I was growing in Honduras, you know, Honduras is the only Latin American country that has a full U.S. military base. So, and we get hit a lot, you know, by hurricanes. And it's a lot of, you know, devastation, you know, and then it's a poor country. So the memories that I have is that Americans arriving to Honduras after, you know, we got hit by a hurricane with food, you know, and clothing, and so every day they found me sitting in front of the U.S. military base, staring at the U.S. military base, literally like stalking, you know, the U.S. military. And I used to say, wow, you know, what is the feel to be part of the greatest army in the world? And that was my dream. I said, one day I want to be an American soldier. And then in Honduras, you know, I mean, come on now. You know, you're a little girl, you know, in a third world country, dreaming to be a soldier of, you know, the greatest nation. I mean, you know that it's impossible, right? And then I'm like, no, it's not. I'm going to be a soldier, you know. But I didn't know what it means or what I was saying. I know that I wanted it. At the age of 17, I decided to come to the U.S. And then I was 6 months pregnant. Today is July 26th. So today, July 26th, 1992.
Is when you came to the United States?
Yes. So I just look at the date. Yes, yes.
Wow, happy anniversary.
Yes. So that will be 27 years ago.
You said at 13, you got pregnant.
Yes. And then people not even question, you know, like why you are so young and pregnant. Why? And I will tell you, you know, it wasn't like my own will to get pregnant. But nobody questioned anything. You know why? Because it's normal. My daughter, yeah, my daughter, you know, I mean, she's fine. She's fine. She was born fine. You know, I did have a C-section though.
So when you came in 1992, you had a daughter and you were pregnant again.
Yes. So when I decided to, you know, to leave Honduras, you know, I'm like, I don't want this. I don't want this life. Yeah. I don't want to, you know, be getting pregnant against my will, you know, just because somebody decides that they can help me. And then I have a daughter and I don't want this for my daughter either. I don't want it. And then I grab my daughter and then I decide to leave Honduras. And then I went through that journey, you know, that asylum seekers, you know, are going right now, you know, going through, you know, Guatemala and going through Mexico and going to, you know, arriving at the border. A lot of people, you know, ask, you know, like, you know, why you didn't do it the right way? And then I'm like, okay, you know, I'm smart enough to, you know, leave my country for a better life for my kids, running away, you know, from danger, you know, and high crime, you know, and abuse, you know, and trying to save, you know, your children's for that. And then you, you know, get the guts and say, you know what, enough is enough, I'm leaving, you know. But there is some intelligence to that.
I would love to point out for people who might be unaware that seeking asylum is a legal right that is still lawful. It was lawful in 1992, and it's still lawful today to present yourself at a border and to ask for asylum. And so that's what you decided to do.
What they said is that, you know, you should do it legally, meaning that you shouldn't, you know, sneak in, which I did. You know, I admit, I didn't present myself at the border, you know, because the process is so hard. So when I arrive at Nogales, I ask, okay, so how do I go to the other side, you know, with my 6 month, you know, belly, you know, and my child. And then this guy, he just look at me and like think he feels sorry for me. And he says, you know what? He says the less danger, because it's hot right now. It's hot. So you cannot go through the desert. So I'm going to show you how you can do it. So then he took me to like a sewer, you know, kind of tunnel that, you know, it was like underground. It was filthy. It was, you know, dark. It was just horrible, you know. And then that's how I crossed, you know, clinching, you know, to my daughter. Yeah. And, he told me, you know, where to, he says, you know what, you're just going to see this, like windows, you know, you will see this window. So on the third one, that's the U.S. So that's where you're going to, you know, get out, you know, from there, because the tunnel just keep going and then you don't want to get lost. So when I, you know, made it to the other side, the U.S., you know, side, the Border Patrol was waiting for me, you know, because I was coming, you know, like from the ground.
Yeah.
So they're standing right there, and I put my daughter first, you know, but I never let her go. I'm holding her, you know, by her hand. So at that point, I made the decision, and I'm like, you know what? I think it's safer that even if I let her go, she will be safer in the U.S. And then when I came out of, you know, the store, you know, the border, it was two Border Patrol agents, and they said, hi. I said, hi. He says, what are you doing here? And I said, well, you know, I came because I want to join in the army. He says, that's interesting. Uh-huh. Very interesting, you know. You come out of a sewer, crossing the border illegally, and the first thing that you said, yes, you know, came because I want to join in the army. So, you know, they arrest me, and then from there, you know, I was transferred to some kind of shelter in Tucson. But they look for a sponsor, you know, they asked me if I have relatives, and then I did have a sister at the time, you know, who was a U.S. citizen, you know, so they contacted her, and then she said that, yeah, that she was going to, you know, take care of me, and she bailed me out. She actually paid. She paid $1,000 for us, you know, to be released under her care. You know, she was upset. She's like, what are you doing here? You're 17, 6 months pregnant and with the child. What are you doing here? And I said, well, I can't because I want to join in the army. She said, are you crazy or are you joking? And then I said, no, that's why I came. And then she says, you know, that is not going to happen. I kept, you know, like bugging her and bugging her, you know, to take me. And she says, you know what, I'm going to take you for them to tell you, you know, that that is not possible. So you could leave me alone, you know. So she took me to a U.S. Army recruiting station. And then they said, yes, you know, she can join, even though that she was born in another country. But in order for her to do that, she needs a 551 visa. And then she needs to, of course, you know, learn English. I said, well, I can do that in 2 months. And then she says, okay. And then we don't take people that is pregnant. Well, you know, I'm not going to be pregnant, you know, whatever, you know, 2-3 months, you know, and the child is going to be out, you know. So they were giving me all these requirements. And then I said, okay, I said, so what is the max and minimum age to join? And he says, well, the minimum is 17 if you have all those requirements. I said, okay, what is the max? He says, well, the max is 21. And the max, he says, is 42. And I said, not 21? He says, no, 42. So then it was such a relief for me because I told my sister, I say, you know what? I will not leave my kids and I will not need a babysitter because it's 42. And then she's like, so you're telling me that you're going to wait until those kids grow up, you know, for you to join in the military? And then I said, well, you said that I need a babysitter. And then she says, well, you also need a green card. And I said, yeah, that's true. Let's go figure it out, the green card part.
So at no point in this whole process, from leaving Honduras to making the journey across Central and South America, was there ever a point where you just felt like, this is too hard, this is too much?
You know what it is, but I, you know, I compare it to, you know, like when you, I don't know if you're a mother.
Yes, I am.
But, okay, so, you know, that when you're going to deliver a child, that is scary, it is painful, but you're excited.
Yes.
So basically that is the feeling. Yes, of course, you know, it's scary. But when you have the child, you know, in your arms, it's so worth it. And you not even think about what you went through. So with the green card, I told my sister, I said, let's go see an attorney. And she says, okay, you know. So we go to see the attorney. And the immigration attorney says, you can file for her. Because, you know, you are a U.S. citizen and a sibling can petition for another sibling. The problem with that is that a green card from a sibling to sibling, it takes anywhere from 15 to 20 years. In the meantime, you know, I was not going to get any immigration relief, meaning that, okay, your sister's going to file for you. You know, we're going to file with immigration and basically, you know, you should sit and wait until that visa becomes available. But in the meantime, you are not authorized to work. But, you know, if you get arrested by immigration or whatever, you know, that is no protection. You're going back. They're going to send you back. So so she filed, you know, for the green card. And then at the same time, you know, we filed for asylum. And then through the asylum, I did get, my daughter and I, we got an authorization to work. And I was, you know, I was always working. You know, I clean houses, offices, I cook, and then I sell food, you know, in tire shops, you know, and in mechanical shops, you know, those, you know, Latino small businesses, you know, I used to do that, you know. Finally, in 1998, you know, I, after, you know, going through the denial of my asylum petition and then appealing it, you know, they said, you know what, you had, you know, your asylum has not been granted and therefore you have to go back to your country. We cannot send you back, you know, with your child because we don't have the facilities to hold you and send you. But we will give you the opportunity to depart the country, you know, voluntarily. So by this date, you know, you will come back with your bags and everything and your plane tickets back to Honduras. And then from here, basically, you will be escorted, you know, to the airport. So that way, you know, we saw that you leave the country, you know.
So your first application for asylum was actually denied?
It was denied. you know, it's not that I didn't have a case. It's just that I was young and naive. So my daughter and I, we went with bags and everything, you know, to basically be sent back. And when we were in front of the judge, he says, you know what? He says, we cannot send you back to your country because hurricane destroyed 90% of your country. And therefore, the government just gave a relief, which is called temporary protected status, the TPS, that this administration just removed. And then because of that, you know, we cannot send you back. So he says you need to file for that, you know, and then it has been granted for 18 months. So for 18 months, you will be allowed to stay in the country and then to work because you're going to get a work permit. So I turn around with my back, you know, I didn't think about, oh my God, you know, they just made me spend $1,200 on plane tickets. But I'm not going to use.
So you had to purchase, when you received the order of removal, you purchased your plane ticket for the day and time that they told you to.
Oh, yes, because it's voluntary departure. Yes, you do that out of your pocket. Yes.
Voluntary self-deportation. But in the end, you were saved by a hurricane.
Yes. When I got my basically kind of, you know, in a different word, a final order of deportation, I had already bought a condominium. I bought a condominium, you know, and then I was working, I was living fine, you know, I had, you know, my little savings, you know, and all that, you know, I had everything, you know, ready. So, but since I was leaving the country, you know, I sold everything that I had under my name.
Then how long were you here before your first asylum attempt was denied?
So basically, you know, the whole process until basically from my file, when they said no, you know, I mean, you run out of options and you live in the country, it was 6 years.
6 years.
Yes.
So in that time period, you had purchased a condominium and saved money. And so you sold all of that for your,
yes,
to depart voluntarily.
Yes.
Do you remember the name of the hurricane that saved you?
Yes. Mitch. Which, you know what? Ironically, I was born in the middle of a hurricane, and that was called Fifi.
Wow. Hurricanes follow you around.
Yes. I'm glad that I live in Arizona and we don't have hurricanes here.
So tell me then what happened after Hurricane Mitch saved you and you got your temporary protected status.
Basically, it's like I got my dream back and I can continue working for my goal of the reason why I came to the U.S., you know. But the reality is that right there and there, I was homeless.
Yeah.
I didn't have anything. All I had was what we could fit in those bags. That was it. And we turn around, you know, and can start, you know, all over again. A year later, yeah, 99, a year later, September of 99, you know, I bought a house. I dream of how I was going to defend myself, you know, and the reason I was going to give the judge for not, why not to remove me. You know, I'm contributing to this country, you know. I mean, look at me. This is what I have done and this and that, you know. I bought the house that I wanted, exactly how I had it in that drawing. It wasn't a cul-de-sac, you know, it was a four-bedroom, and then it had the swimming pool. I always said, you know what, I want to have the freedom to have a child. Not that I didn't want the other ones, but how are you supposed to have a child? You know, that you plan it, and then you have everything, and you accept the child, you know, and then you have a room, you know how you see, you just see that on TV when you in a third world country, you know?
Yeah, to have a child, to have control over the choices that you make and control over your body.
That, yes, that, but not only that, but you know, you're pregnant and then you go and tell your partner I'm pregnant, you know, and the partner is excited, you know, and then, you know, and then painting a room, you know, and buying a crib and all those little things, you know, that you only see on TV. That's what I wanted. That was my dream. And I'm like, I want to have a child. I never had that experience before, you know, something that Americans have for granted.
Yeah. Well, so I was just doing some quick math. So your home, you've purchased your first home when you were 25, and that's when you decide that you want to have this experience of enjoying a pregnancy.
Yes.
So what happened?
I went from paying, I believe like $400 a month, you know, to $1,000 payment. So it was huge, you know. So yeah. I need to adjust to that, you know, and then I was cleaning houses, you know, and then I had to pick up, you know, another job to clean offices at night for me to get to that. Getting five different jobs in order, you know, for me, you know, to pay the bills and get everything done, you know, and then January I got pregnant. And I'm like, okay, you know, I mean, this is only 4 months. I am still not used to this new payment. You know, how I'm going to do? I mean, I'm going to get sick. How long I can work for? You know, I'm working with chemicals because, you know, now I'm American, right?
Yes.
Oh, my God, the chemicals. And you have to go organic and this and that. Okay, you know, like, oh, my God, I'm allergic to this, you know? And oh my God, you know, I just cannot handle gluten.
that was my next question. Did you suddenly develop a gluten intolerance or?
Well, you know, Americans, you know, they're so spoiled that they have all these weird allergies. No, I was worried because I'm like, I'm pregnant now. I'm cleaning houses. And in my mind, you know, I'm American, I'm weaker now, you know. I was fine, you know, I came through a sewer, you know, with a three-year-old child, you know. But now I'm worried that my child is not going to run in a backyard because of the germs, you know. Yeah. So, yeah. In April, I go to the doctor, you know, and they told me, congratulations, ma'am. You know, I said, what is it? Is it a boy or a girl? And they said, well, not a girl, but it's not exactly a boy. I said, what do you mean? And I'm so scared. They said, you're having twins. And I'm like, okay, you know. So, you know, I had everything planned, right? I have my house, 4 bedrooms, you know, one for each daughter and the child that I'm going to have. But now it's twins.
Yep.
So I got my twins. They were born in September of 2000.
And these are twin boys?
Twin boys.
I had twin boys in September of 2002. I know all about what that surprise is like. Like, it's not one baby, it's actually two.
Yes.
Okay, so you have your twins in September. So tell me, what are you still thinking at this point about joining the Army? You know, have 4 children. Was that still
your dream? Well, now at this point, you know, when my twins were born, you know, I was 26 years old. And then I'm like, okay, you know, I mean, I with this pregnancy, you know, I cannot eat too much with this too, and I don't want to gain weight because if I get the green card sooner, you know, I cannot be fat because now I got all the requirements. The weight.
So it was still your dream to join the Army?
It was my dream to join in the Army. So I continue working, you know, I continue renewing my TPS year after year after year. Mm. Continue renewing my TPS. I call my sister and I say, you know what? We're ready to adjust the status and get the green card. And she says, are you sure? I said, yep, I just saw the list and we made the cut. And she's like, okay, you know. So we started getting everything together, you know, and it was April of 2008. We did everything, went to the attorney, filed, you know, or whatever we had to file. You know how much was it? About $20,000. $20,000, you know, in immigration fees and the attorney. And because remember, our asylum case, was freeze. So now we have to find an attorney that can go to the court and open that case and at the same time do, you know, our green card. So that is expensive. 70% of the Americans don't have $1,000 saved right now.
How did you pay for your visas?
You know, I was ready because I knew one day it was going to come.
So you worked hard and you lived within your means. And
exactly.
When you needed $25,000 to pay for your visas, you had it and you were able to.
So we were granted, you know, permanent resident status right there, you know, in court. So I was so excited. I was so happy. And then I'm like, okay, you know, so I'm going to join the military. And then I went to Rocky Point twice, you know, to see how it feels to cross the border legally. Right. And then when I came back, you know, from the weekend, I went to the recruiting station, you know, at the U.S. Army recruiting station. And I went, I think I was 32, 33 at the time. So then I went and then I said, I want to join in the Army. And then I got I don't have my actual green card yet, but the judge stamped it in my passport. And then I speak English now. They look at me, you know, like if I was the same person that I was there, you know, like, I don't know, 16 years before.
Uh-huh.
He gave me the checklist. Basically, you know, checking the box. I had every single requirement. So then they sent me to do, you know, the ASVAB test. And then I passed it, you know. And then I passed it. But it was one little detail. He says, "Where do you go to school?" And then I'm like, "I didn't go to school." And he's like, "You didn't go to school." I said, "No. What is your high school diploma?" I said, "Well, I didn't go to high school." Well, you need that. And then I'm like, oh my God, they didn't tell me about this. And then I'm like, okay, you know, I'm in my 30s. I have 4 kids. I mean, going to high school is like 4 or 5 years. Do I have to start from what I left off, which was 6th grade? How am I going to do this, you know? So then he says, you know what? You need to go and find out about the GED. So I went and find out and I said, okay, how I do this GED? And then they said, well, the GED is the equivalent of the high school. And then you have to study. How long do I have to study? He said, well, it's at your own pace. Okay, so it's at my own pace. So you're telling me that if I read all the books and memorize everything today, I can come and test tomorrow. He said, you can test right now if you like. I said, really? I said, okay, so let me test.
So right then and there, you took the GED test?
I took the GED test and I passed it with flying colors.
I'm really not surprised.
So I passed it, you know, and then I said, I got it. I got it. He's like, okay, you know, good, you know. August 20th, 2008. August 20th of 2008, I was in basic training in the U.S. Army. In Fort Leonard, and then people, you know, tell me, I mean, that is for the smart people. And I said, I know, that's why I joined, because I know that I'm smart, you know.
So you're 34 and you are in basic training, realizing your dream of joining the Army. What is that like?
You know what? At that time, you know, when I joined, I was making about $80,000 a year.
Before you joined?
Yeah, like at the time that I joined, I was making $80,000 a year. So I learned how to do taxes, and then I went, you know, to those companies that offered the classes or whatever, and I was really good with numbers, you know, and doing taxes. So I had my own clientele, and I was able to open, you know, my own office and all that. So I had basically my own business. And also, you know, I had a trucking company. And then I owned, you know, like 3 semis, and I was transporting, you know, blocks, like construction blocks. I didn't care about the money. That was my dream. You're crazy. You know, I mean, you know how many people wanted to make that kind of money? And I said, I know, you know, but, you know, you start working when you find the job that you love. And this is what I want. This is what I came for. I never said that I wanted to come to the US and make $100,000 a year. You know, I said that I wanted to join the military And that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I left my kids, you know, with their father. And then they were 8 years old. They said, well, you know what? I mean, you're not going to make it. You know, that's for the smart people, young people, you know, males. So everything is against you. Everything. I'm like, you know what? I never said that I want the army as a career. All I said was, how does it feel to be part of the greatest army in the world? One day, I want to be one of them. So if I sleep one day in a U.S. military installation as a soldier, I fulfill my dream.
What are some of the things you remember about your first days in the military, adapting, fulfilling your dream?
Well, you know what? It didn't strike me much, you know, like the first days. You know, I mean, it's scary. I mean, and then they yell at you because they're building up to, you know, whatever is coming, you know. And it was hard because, you know, I'm determined. You know, I'm a mom. You know, I'm a mom of an adult. You know, like all those kids, the privates, you know, they are the age of basically my kids.
Right.
You know. And then, you know, we have to do all these obstacles, you know, and then climbing and doing this and doing that, you know. And then, and you know, I'm a mom, you know, and then these kids are teenagers, you know, and they come from different walks of life. And the way they talk, and they're so rude and so disrespectful, you know, and they talk to me this way. And I just looking at them like, didn't your mama show you some manners, you know? So it was a huge, huge cultural shock.
Right.
Huge. Everything is in a language that is not your language.
Right.
It's a completely different language, and it's a different lingo too. All these acronyms, you know, that's when I learned it, you know, that okay, you know, so you're gonna PCS, you know, and then you know, like the BYD and then this and that and blah blah, and then we're having a party and BYB, you know, and then the last day of basic training, we went through this basically final test, you know, and it was like simulation of war, and we were like under a wire, you know, and then we were, it feels and it seems like, you know, that we've been under attack, and then it's chaos, you know, and it's bombs, you know, but it's all, you know, it's not real, but it feels so real, you know. The drill sergeant has told you, you know, that if you don't pass that, and then if you don't find, you know, that the path that you're supposed to find and go and find it to meet your families on the other side, then you're not going to pass basic training. They then going to recycle, and then they can kick you out of the military. So that's all that is stress because they want to create that, right?
Right.
So I found the pathway, you know. And then I'm tired, you know, because it's like 8 hours, you know, full bottle rattle, you know, with all the equipment, which is about 90 pounds, you know, and then I'm sweating, I'm starving, you know, and then I'm tired because all this is being, you know, that specific, you know, final test, but the whole thing has been going on for a week, you know, so I'm exhausted. And finally, I saw all this kind of like candle lights, you know, on the side. And then I'm like, okay, so this is, you know, I'm going the right direction. So right to the candle, you know, light, it was this soldiers in one side and the other, you know, of the little pathway, you know. So the chaplain, you know, came and then he looked at me and then he says, Private Villanova, welcome to the United States Army. Mm. You have earned your citizenship. And I look at him, I couldn't resist it. I went on my knees and then I cried. I cried. And I'm like, you know, I still can cry right now, you know, like, you know, it just, you know, and when he said, you earned your citizenship, he wasn't talking to me specifically because I was born in another country. That's what they said to all Americans that go to the U.S. military. Now you have earned your citizenship. But when he told me that, I'm like, okay, you know, so you're telling me that I'm not at risk to go back to my country. So after, you know, me becoming a soldier and going to all the training, you know, and going to my job training and all that, I received orders in February of 2009 for my first overseas assignment, which was in South Korea. So now my goal is, so I can wait, you know, those 5 years to apply for a citizenship. So when I arrive in South Korea in February, I already have my paperwork, and then I file my citizenship in the U.S. Embassy in South Korea.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Yes. In April of 2009, 2-3 months after, you know, I arrived in South Korea.
Right.
I was sworn in as a U.S. citizen.
Were you sworn in South Korea?
Yes, I became a citizen in South Korea.
That's amazing. So how did you change because of your military service? Did you change?
I'm more American, you know. I mean, I got into a fight because somebody was burning the American flag, and I just jumped on top of him. Started shocking the person. Mm-hmm. But you have to keep in mind too that I went to war, and then I'm a, you know, basically a disabled veteran. I suffered from PTSD.
So tell me more about how that happened.
A lot of veterans will not talk, you know, about exactly what happened.
Right.
You know.
Right.
They will not talk about it, but I went through a lot. I went through a lot in the military. I believe that the military, although that was my dream, to me, it was like when you fall in love with this person and you, the person is perfect and that's all you want. And you just dream to marry this person, and there is nothing wrong with this person. But then you have, you know, the family members or friends or whatever, and say, you know what, the person is not good for you. I hear this about this, or, you know, no, you know, and you're just like, no, you know, you're just blind for that person, you know? And then you finally fulfill your dream, you know, by marrying that person, you know? And the person is still good, you know? But it's one time, you know, when you realize that, you know, this is a monster. You know, what the hell, what I was thinking, you know?
Yeah.
And then that's how the military was. You know, the Americans that I met and remember and saw in Honduras, not the same Americans now.
How so?
Cold, not compassionate. The American, you know, soldiers, when they go with all this aid and this compassion, and they, you know, like go and grab this ill kid or hurt, you know, or rescue, you know, bodies, you know, injured people, you know, that's the American that I knew. That's the American that I remember. That's the American that I missed in this time.
So 21 years later, by the time you finally were able to join the army, it was a different experience than what you expected it to be?
The discrimination, you know, that, you know, it goes on, you know, the harassment, you know, with the females. And then keep in mind, you know, I'm a female. I am an immigrant. I'm older and I have accent. They didn't appreciate the fact that, okay, she's older, she's mature. You know, maybe she can help us with this knucklehead kid, you know? Well, you know, she has accent. She must be smart because she speaks more than one language. No, I'm stupid because I don't know how to speak English.
So is that some of the racism that you encountered in the military?
Daily.
Daily.
Daily. The discrimination, you know, because of the accent, because I was a female, or, you know, say, I mean, tell you things like, you must not have anything to eat. you know, over there, because you're joining the military, being this so old. Are you sure you can run? Are you sure you can handle this?
So how long were you in the military then?
So, you know, so from South Korea, you know, I came back to the U.S. and then I stayed here for a couple of months in Colorado. And then I went back. They sent me to Iraq and then back to the U.S. So I was back and forth until I got medical retirement in 2015. So it was almost 8 years.
So were you glad to leave the military?
You know what? Again, with comparing, I believe the military is like a bad marriage. You cannot leave with the person, you know, and you can't wait to get divorced. But as soon as you finalize that divorce, you know, you miss the person or you miss the routine.
So what did you miss?
It's so many things, you know. I mean, waking up and going over there, you know, I guess the adrenaline, you know, like you got orders to, you know, to Germany and you're going to be over there in 48 hours, you know, the routine. Because, you know that they retrained you to be a civilian again? For a year before you get out, they retrain you to be a civilian. Because while you're in the military, you know, you're like, you're going to go do this, and this, and that, and make it happen now, right? But once you're a civilian, even though that you might own that company, or you're the big boss, you cannot talk like that. So you go like, hey, so, you know, it is in your best interest that please do this and do that and comply with all this. And I expect to have it done by, you know, I'm less sensitive. And when I'm telling you sensitive, I mean, I wouldn't be doing all this work, you know, with the asylum seekers if I'm not sensitive. I am sensitive, but I don't show it. I don't show emotion.
Do you regret having joined the military?
No, I do not. I do not, because, you know, in to this administration, you know, I rub that in the face of this administration, everybody, that every time that I go to a rally. I went, what is your excuse, you know? No, I do not. I do not regret it. You know, I am, you know, with all my medical care and then my pension, you know, and all that. And thanks to that, you know, I'm able to do what I do, you know, because I have the freedom, you know, to go help them, you know, and then I don't have to work. I cannot work. I mean, they the type of disability that they gave me, it was, I'm not employable. It says that with unemployability. And then my daughter, the one that I brought up with me, she is 30 years old. She finished, you know, her bachelor. She's a third grade teacher. She got married. She has two little boys. And next month, in August, she's expecting the third boy, and she doesn't know what is going to be first because they're close in age. The birth of her third son or her master's graduation.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
Yes. So she did it. And then the little one, you know, the little one that I was pregnant with when I came, she graduated this May with a bachelor's in communication.
Let's talk for just a minute about getting back to your work with the refugees and asylum seekers in the Phoenix area. It was your daughter who first connected you.
Yeah.
But why did you keep showing up to help?
Because in every single person, you know, especially those moms, I see myself and my daughter. And at the beginning, you know, it was so many roles, like, you know, let's get donation and sorting. I'm like, not too good, you know, with sorting clothing. So let's do this and let's do that and this and that, you know. I used to go to the churches at the beginning, you know, from the arrival all the way to when they go to bed. And then before they go to bed, you know, I mean, we hosted people with my husband. It was at one point that it was so chaos, you know, that people were being dropped at the bus stations. And then it was the churches, because it was like so many people, or, you know, the churches had usually happen on the weekends, because, you know, the churches have their, you know, service on you know, like on Sundays, right? So they didn't have that space. So that's when my husband and I, you know, we used to jump in and host it 40, 50 people at once.
Wow. In your home?
In my house.
50 people.
You know what? The thing is that my PTSD got so much better. Before, I couldn't leave the house. I couldn't be in an open space. I couldn't be, you know, like, you know, noises, you know, bother me. Mm-hmm. I was triggered by a lot of things. And then since I started working with them, I was in 11 different medications. I do not take medications now.
So you went from 11 different medications to none?
To none.
Why do you think that happened?
Because I have a purpose, you know, because, I mean, I'm helping, because, you know, I mean, because I think I got too American, that I need a pill for everything, you know, and then I realized that, you know what, the only thing American that you have is your citizenship and the love for this country, you know, but you Hondurans, and Hondurans are go-getters. I used to go to every single church and tell them my story. I'm like, you know what? I mean, you will work. And then, you know, I mean, whatever goal that you have in mind, don't let anybody tell you that you cannot do it. And then I used to ask them, you know, I mean, what would you like? And they said, well, I would like to buy a house. My dream is to have a car. My dream is to send my kids, you know, to the school. I want my kids to be safe. I want my kids to have an education. And they tell me all this. And then I used to tell them, I said, what do you think is harder? For you to accomplish every single one of those goals that you just told me, or for me to join in the military? What do you think is easier? And then I said, yours is a piece of cake, right? They said, yeah, so you will have no problem getting to that.
What is something that you wish other Americans understood about refugees and asylum seekers and the process?
I want them to understand that we are not dumb, you know, that we will have or if the opportunity to come legally to the U.S. what's available to us, we can do that. We don't break the law. We are forced to break the law out of desperation. That's the only way, you know, that we can, you know, save our kids. And we are capable people, you know. I am a U.S. combat veteran. And people still ask me for my birth certificate. People still doubt my military service. People still think, you know, that I'm lying because I'm brown and because I have an accent. Mm. I remember, you know, it used to be times when people, Americans, used to come and tell you, oh, my God, I love your accent. It sounds so sexy, or it sounds so this. I love it. I love accent, you know. And now, you know, it's offensive. Mm. When it used to be sexy, and then I enjoy it, and then I like the accent, to I hate it. That's how much this, you know, it has changed.
What do you hope that you will be able to accomplish as you help asylum seekers and refugees?
I will continue, I mean, doing this. Every asylum seeker, you know, I mean, last time, you know, that we went through the list of how many people we had, it was over 500 people that went through our house from, I would say, December to May, you know. That's how many we had in our house. Every single one of them, you know, they have my number. And then I said, if you ever need anything, you know, you doubt about something, you know, I mean, call me. Call me, you know. My hope is, you know, like, continue to be like a guidance to them, especially to the females, because even as an American and educated women, you know, we are not, getting paid the same amount of money that the males are getting paid. So mm-hmm. imagine being a female, being Latino, not speaking the language, an asylum seeker. You know, I mean, it's harder. So for me to educate them and say, hey, you know what? You don't have to be touched. You know, if it's your boss or whatever you work, you can report it. Don't be afraid. You know, you have rights. You know, things that I did not know, you know, when I first came. I like to empower this, especially the female, you know, asylum seekers, you know, that the only obstacle, you know, that is between them and their goal is whatever negative that people tell them and what they believe.
Right.
That's the only thing, you know. Other than that, you know, the sky is the limit. So my hope is that they get to a state. I mean, I hate the feeling of, have the feeling of I'm settled, you know. I bought a house and my kids are in school and I'm doing good. And then I'm supporting my parents, you know, back in my country, you know, and I'm making a life and I'm happy when they come and said, oh, I'm sorry, you know, but you don't qualify for asylum and now you have to go back. And that is, you know, that I hate, you know, for them to go through, you right. know, that, you know, the kids, you know, that they already learning English and they're already in school, you know, for a judge to come or an administration to say, oh, no, you're not welcome. Oh, no, you're not allowed. Not because you don't qualify for asylum, but because they say so. And that is my fear. So that's why I'm always, you know, like talking to them, you know, like don't miss your court dates, you know, I mean, find an attorney, you know, get a job, you know, clean houses, you know, I mean, do this. And see, the thing with them is these asylum seekers, you know, they are in a lot worse situation, you know, that I was in. You know why? So they have an ankle monitor and they are being checked at their house or where they live in once a week, and they have to go and check in at the ICE office twice a week. So imagine, you know, a mother with a child being watched constantly, you know, she cannot even work because there's so many miles that you can go. I mean, I have seen it where an asylum seeker was working. You know, he has a wife and two young kids. And then he was working at a barber shop. And I went to the barber shop and told, you know, the owner, you know what? You can, this you gave job to this person. And can it's illegal to hire an illegal alien. He's not an illegal alien. He's been vetted by this government. So why not giving them an authorization to work? So they setting them up for failure. And then how they find out? Because of the ankle monitor. Because they're being watched. And I think that's horrible. I have seen asylum seekers, you know, I saw one the other day, has been with the ankle monitor for 18 months. With the baby, yeah.
Anyone who knows about immigration in our country, the only thing that we'll agree on is that it's kind of a mess, right? That there's all these different problems and difficulties, and everybody has different ways of solving them. But you've gotten involved on a personal level to just do what you can for the people that you come in contact with. How has that changed you?
Ooh, you know what? It has changed me a lot. I will say that I got to American. I got to American to a certain extent. The brand name clothes, you know, and expensive purses, you know, because I can afford it and I'm American now, you know, and my expensive shoes, you know, and buying all expensive things to my kids so they can be happy, you know, things like that. And when I went back to my reality, you know, to what I came from, you know, that you give a toy, a used toy to a child, you know, and you see those smiles, because I never had one before. Okay, you know, so I like $150 shoes. And then I used to go to the store and I'm like, oh my God, how many asylum seekers can I feed with all this money? Right. This must be a sin, you know? It helped me land, you know, that I want to be the American that I knew growing up, you know? But I'm also the Honduran that I understand where they're coming from. I understand why they're doing it, you know? And then I'm going to help them, you know, in anywhere, you know, that I can. That, you know, to enjoy more simple things and be a lot more grateful, that's what I have learned from all this experience, being a lot more humble.
Is there anything in all of the difficulty and all of the, even though you and I, actually you and I did have one evening where we worked together all night and we didn't know each other. And it was,
really?
It was at City Church. Yeah. I was helping gather all the information for people who needed travel arrangements. And so I would come into the room and call people's name and find them and get their information. And you were on the other side of the room talking to them about what we were going to do, making them stay in their seats because they all wanted to get up and come talk to me at once. And you were like, sit down. She's going to come find you. You don't get up and talk to her. and so you and I worked together this whole evening. And I know from experience that sometimes that can be overwhelming. And when you're doing that day after day after day, sometimes this work with people who are desperate and who are hungry and who are dirty and who need so much help can feel overwhelming. But is there anything that you hold on to that gives you hope?
In what way?
Well, you keep showing up, right? You keep helping. You keep coming back for more.
Because they keep coming.
Right?
Because they keep coming. They keep coming. And then, the law, you know, change, you know, from one day to the next.
Right.
So being one of them, have gone through that process, you know, being in those shoes, you know, being in that journey, when they leaving, you know, either to the hosted families or to the bus station or to the airport, they come and hug me and said, Señor, muchas gracias. Yeah. Thank you so much. You have to let them know that they're on their own. And they need to be able to defend themselves, know their rights, and know when to ask and what to ask. Because, you know, we just had them for 24 hours, you know, 48 hours max, you know. And to me, it's a training, and it's my goal that they go well-informed, you know, that they win their cases, you know. And then I explain them about sexual assaults and domestic violence and relationships, you know, and older, you know, adults, you know, and minors, you know, human trafficking, you know, that people can take advantage of them, you know, by underpaying them, you know, all those things. And I don't want them to go through what I went through. I lived it. So I do as much as I can to prevent that, you know, at least that if they go in through that situation, like, oh, yeah, I remember the woman over there, you know, with the big hair, when I went to the church, she said that if I ever found myself in this situation, this is what I need to do. And believe me, they do remember.
Yeah. Do you have hope for the asylum seeker coming to the United States still? Do you still think it's a good idea?
I think, honestly, I think it's a good idea, but I also tell them, I ask them, why did you came and what is your goal? It is a good idea when you have a goal in mind and keep pursuing that goal. Because it doesn't matter, you know, if you're running away from violence, you know, running away from whatever you're running away from, you know. But, okay, you run away, you say, now what? Life continues.
Well, is there anything else that you would want people listening to this podcast to know about you or about your work?
that that is a lot of people behind the scenes. There is a lot of volunteers. There is a lot of small organizations, you know, that that need help. You don't need much. I mean, you can get toiletries that you get in a hotel, you know, during your vacations. You know, we use that. They need that. Because we think about the asylum seekers, you know, but nobody thinks about the volunteers doing this full time. If you work at a spa, you know, a volunteer, you know, send them a certificate for the massage, certificate for the manicure, a pedicure, the coffee shop.
Well, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me today. I was fascinated by your story the very first time I heard it, about the woman who came here to join the military. And as you told me the details, it's even just more fascinating. And thank you for sharing it with me and with us and for all the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to me.